Okay, first of all, let me also thank you very much for arranging this very timely meeting and for giving me the chance to present to you some perhaps slightly unorthodox ideas as to how one might look at this whole situation of finding the quark gluon plasma. Let me just briefly, the title of my talk, let me just briefly show you the menu after an introduction. I will review a little bit the recent results in statistical QCD that Frank had alluded to. Then I will, in the remainder of the talk, address various probes with which one can hope to study the new phase of matter predicted by QCD and the transition. So perhaps I can put this over here. And So what we want to do in high energy nuclear collisions, as you're all very much aware, is to study experimentally the states of matter and the transition predicted by QCD. And to do that, we have to identify suitable probes. And this is unfortunately complicated by a number of problems which, at least from a theoretical point of view, no one asked for. I mean, what we wanted was a box of this matter, and we wanted to heat it and cool it and increase its density. And what we got instead are all these problems caused by nuclear collision. We have a very non-thermal initial state, and we don't really know whether that ever leads to a thermalized final state that we want to study. Even if it does, there's nuclear geometry, so we don't have homogeneous matter, but we have matter which is maybe cooler along the edges or less dense along the edges. So it's certainly not uniform. And then in the evolution, there is expansion and cooling, and so the information that we finally get is a superposition of information from all these different stages. Furthermore, the probes that we want to use in general, most of them, as you will see, have to be also produced by the collision. And the fact that this production occurs in nuclear matter modifies the probe production. As you all know, there is nuclear shadowing for partons, there's multiple scattering of partons, there's energy loss of partons in nuclear matter. And this is all something that we're not really asking for. These produced probes, then, once they're there, interact not only with the medium that we want to probe, but they also interact with the matter of the nuclei, which are still around. And this leads to things like normal J psi suppression, normal jet quenching in cold nuclear matter. That means, again, effects that we didn't really ask for. So somehow, there are extraneous effects which really obscure the essential problem when we want to study it with nuclear collisions. The essential problem being to identify the state of matter and the transition. So what I want to do is I want to simplify the world a little bit, which from a point of view of a theorist I can do. I needed some moral support for that, and I found that in a remark by Einstein. And I hope that I will be able to keep on that ridge for as long as possible before I fall down. So what I want to do then is a Gedanken experiment in which I assume that I have a fixed volume, a bubble of sort of nuclear size, filled with strongly interacting matter in thermal and chemical equilibrium, filled uniformly, and a device to adiabatically add and remove heat from this. Since this is an experiment, I should show you my experimental setup. And that is shown here. So what we want to find out then is what's going on in there. I'll leave that to the experts. Okay, so with that given, we then want to ask whether in this very much simplified world in which I'm afraid, from a really technical point of view, removed almost, more than half of the problems that real experimentalists are actually confronted with. For this situation, I want to ask, can we, for each value of the energy density, the energy per volume, identify the state of matter in this bubble somehow? And can we somehow find transition points or indications for transition between different states? If we can solve this problem, on one hand, we might get some hints as how to address the real problem that you are confronted with at RIC and elsewhere. But nevertheless, what remains is certainly difficult enough. But on the other hand, if we can't even solve this problem, then I think it is a very much a matter of belief that we can solve a much, much more complicated one. So I think, in some sense, being able to solve this problem, at least to me, is a prerequisite to having a systematic solution to the other problem. So let me begin then with, I now come to the second part, a brief summary of the theoretical background that we have for this world. The basis in our Gedanken experiment will always be lattice QCD. And so in that sense, I'm glad that Frank put that aside, and I will address this at least a little bit, and it will be addressed much more in some of the talks here. What we know is that, what we know from finite temperature lattice QCD is that the equation of state looks somewhat like that. I will, most of the time, not show you even genuine lattice calculation, but just drawings, because even the lattice theorists behave like experimentalists and add in their pictures so many complications that to explain all that would make the talk much longer. So I've taken the liberty of also treating the lattice data a little bit cavalierly and removing complications from it. So this is the equation of state, a rapidly rising energy density compared to T to the fourth, a less rapidly rising pressure. This is essentially for unquenched QCD with massless quarks and two flavors. There are order parameters, this Frank had mentioned. There is the order parameter in the pure gauge theory limit and the order parameter in the chiral limit. In the chiral limit for massless quarks, we have the chiral condensate, which vanishes at a certain temperature and thereby defines a critical temperature. For finite mass quarks, it doesn't quite vanish, but drops rather quickly. The Polyakov loop is the order parameter in pure gauge theory, where it measures the spontaneous Zn symmetry breaking at a certain temperature, let's say here. If we now bring in quarks, the Polyakov loop, even in the chiral limit, still varies quite rapidly, but at a different point. And presumably, this is the point where the chiral condensate induces not spontaneous, but explicit Zn symmetry breaking through some kind of external effective field. So you see, in the chiral limit, everything happens at this critical temperature, and that's then the deconfinement temperature we wish to talk about. From lattice studies, we further have some information about potentials. In pure gauge theory, we can define the string tension, and that is more or less constant for quite a while and then drops suddenly near TC, where, as in the case of SU2 gauge theory, we have critical behavior in the same universality class as the Ising model. And in the case of SU3, we have a first order transition, just as one finds in the Potts model. What one also gets in lattice QCD is the heavy quark potential. That is, in pure gauge theory, we have the string tension, that's what I had mentioned, rising, giving a potential which rises indefinitely with R. When we introduce dynamical quarks, the string will break at a certain point when we create enough energy to make a constituent quark pair. And that leads to behavior of the type shown here. And the point at which the potential breaks off, that is the height of this plateau, decreases with increasing temperature. And this heavy quark potential, which thereby is something somewhat related to the breakup of a heavy quark pair into a heavy light pair system has the behavior shown here. Again, it remains relatively constant and then drops quite suddenly. What we find thus in this world are two regimes with different scales. The regime below TC, in which there is an intrinsic hadronic scale, and which one you take depends what you are looking at. Take the string tension, the condensate, the proton mass, or the hadron mass, the radii, whatever. And you have a temperature range above TC, in which basically the temperature is the scale, apart from terms in powers of the coupling, which could introduce a further scale, but roughly speaking here, the scale is the temperature. So what we then want to consider are the possible thermodynamic variables in which we can study this behavior. And in thermodynamics, this is no question. The variable that one generally uses to study critical behavior is the temperature, that is the energy per degree of freedom. If we formulate the problem somewhat differently, which one can do, at least in spin systems, that is, if instead of addressing normal critical behavior, we ask when do clusters form, when is the percolation setting, then the relevant variable is the density rather than the temperature. And in this Gedanken experiment that I showed you, the relative variable was the energy that I put in this bubble, so the energy density, and that may very well also be the relevant variable in actual experiments. One sort of unpleasant factor from this line of approach is that the energy density varies very rapidly with temperature, as you know. So if you look at, for example, the typical behavior of the energy density as a function of temperature, you find that between 0.9 TC and 1.1 TC, the energy density changes by a factor 10. So it's not so easy to define a critical energy density. It's really much easier to talk about critical temperatures. Let me leave this out. And so one of the immediate tasks in view of that would be, it would be very helpful to identify a thermometer so that instead of just being able to put energy or remove energy from my bubble, I could tell what is the temperature of the bubble. Second rather amusing point is the behavior that is observed in lattice QCD is something that what one might call late criticality. I mean, if you look at the behavior, the critical behavior in the Ising model of the magnetization, you have a curve that looks like that with a given critical exponent. Now, no one really tells you ever in statistical physics how large the regime is in which this critical behavior is given. But if you look at the region which you have in spin systems and then at the region, the range which you find in gauge theory always seems to give results which are almost constant until you reach TC and then suddenly drop off. This is one such example. But you could, for example, plot the string tension in pure gauge theory and compare it to the magnetization in spin systems, and you find that the magnetization drops rather smoothly for already quite low temperatures, but the string tension in gauge theory really goes constant almost up to TC and then starts dropping. So in some sense, the behavior, this late onset of critical behavior might be some hint for the underlying mechanism. For example, if you take percolation as underlying mechanism, then you would have critical behavior in terms of the density, which of course, because in the limit the two become equal, means that it's also the limit in the temperature. But if you compare 1 minus t cubed corresponding to such a density to the power beta to 1 minus t to the power beta, then you get a behavior which sets in much later. In the actual region around TC, the two are the same, of course. But this late onset of criticality might be some hint of QCD telling us what is really the basic underlying object or what really happens at TC. So summarizing then, the information that we want to get out of our Gedanken experiment is we would like to define a thermometer. We would like to learn about the nature of the medium, whether it's confined or deconfined. We would like to get information on the transition, chiral deconfinement. We would like to learn something about in-medium modifications of light or heavy quark hadrons, and we want to learn about the properties of the hot quark-gluon plasma. I will not address, what I have left out in this list, again, this was rather fortunate, where was a point that Frank had addressed in some detail. That is, I will not talk about fluctuations, tricriticality, and things like that. So I really want to look at my bubble and see what happens when I change the temperature. The probes that I have to sort of go through all the different stages that I cover then, the direct probes, one might classify into two groups. They are, so to speak, non-invasive probes, which are emitted by the medium itself, by leptons and photons, which arise because in the medium, the constituents annihilate or scatter, and in this process emit electromagnetic signals. And then there are invasive probes, but these are really quite painless because they are such rare phenomena. And these are hard external probes which traverse the medium, and this basically means quarkonium beams or hard jets. And what I now want to ask is, what information do these probes then provide given our Gedanken experiment? So let me start with dileptons and photons. Again, let me remind you of what we are looking at. So this medium just sits there, and in the course of sitting there, we watch and have photons or dileptron pairs coming out. What happens is that in the medium, constituents annihilate in the lowest order term to form heavy virtual photons, which then give the lepton pair. And what we measure is the dilepton mass distribution at a fixed dilepton rapidity from this. And what we get is, for the rate, a convolution of the distribution functions of the constituents which annihilate with a cross-section for annihilation and momentum conservation. For the distributions here, we will take thermal distributions of the constituents. That is, if they're hadrons, we will take a thermal hadron distribution. If they're partons, we'll have a thermal parton distribution. So the basic thing is then, what is the cross-section? In the confined phase, presumably the basic cross-section is a number of vector mesons, but I will simplify the situation to saying it is just the row, neglecting other vector mesons and neglecting also Dalitz decays. So then the cross-section is basically given by the row pole, which has the form shown here, with a term in the which leads to a rate containing the contribution of the row pole, and then an exponential fall-off, which comes from the thermal distribution of the hadrons that form this row. Now, inside a medium, both the mass and the width of the row can, of course, depend on temperature. So we have to leave this open. So what we expect then, if we now look at what comes out of our bubble, is a row peak followed by an exponential tail. But we don't know how the peak of the row will change with temperature, because the mass and the width of the row could be modified by temperature. So we look at the data from our experiment, and this data, you will hear in more detail in the talk of Fritjof Karsch, comes from quenched lattice QCD, and what one finds is that as the temperature is varied, the position of the peak stays stable, the height goes down slightly, present accuracy does not really allow one to say anything about the width, but at the same time, the tail keeps going up as I go to higher and higher temperature. So what one finds then is the mass of the row seems to stay essentially constant almost up to TC. About the width, we know very little. And the large M behavior specifies the temperature. This, as I said, is done in quenched lattice QCD without dynamical fermions. Obviously, one would like to have it redone in full QCD with dynamical fermions. In the deconfined state, the rate formula looks the same way, but except for the cross section, where we now have just the virtual photon pole rather than the row pole. This leads to a rate in the lowest approximation, which I've called Born here, and means that I just have an exponential variation in m over t up to a certain constant value. Hard thermal loop calculations, and I'm sure you'll hear about those here, lead to a slightly different behavior with an excess at very small m over t values. The data from the actual Gedanken experiment carried out again in quenched lattice QCD looks quite different. It looks as a function of m, as I've shown it here. That is, one does have the exponential fall off in m over t, but rather than the Born term behavior going to a constant value, one has something like a drop towards very low mass values. And if one now replots this rate as a function of m over t, one has curves which are more or less scaling in m over t. So one rather, perhaps the most surprising thing that comes out of this is, of course, this drop. And one open question is, I mean, if this drop persists in full QCD in this form, what causes it? And one explanation suggested by the people doing the calculations is that this might be a hint for having not really massless quarks and gluons in the medium here, but having quarks which have acquired a thermal mass, and this thermal mass leads to a turnover of this kind. So the dilepton results of our Gedanken experiment are summarized here. We measure the temperature as a function of energy density from the large mass behavior of the dilepton spectrum, and what we get is something like that, which looks very, very much like what Van Hove suggested many years ago for the PT spectrum. Now, the PTs of the hadrons, of course, come from so many different effects that it's not really very easy to identify what comes from where. But for the dileptons, if we could do such a Gedanken experiment, one would clearly expect this form. So given this data, then, we can now measure the position of the peak as a function of temperature, and what we find is it stays constant essentially up to TC, and then it starts rising linearly with temperature, because out here temperature is the only scale, and so it moves out as the temperature increases. So the conclusion on dileptons then is the large M behavior identifies T, and I note here identifies T correctly, because we are checking the temperature using dileptons, but this is done in a lattice QCD calculations, so we know what the temperature is. We wouldn't need the dileptons to fix it, and what we just want to check is, do the dileptons give us the correct temperature? And they do. The temperature-dependent or independent behavior of the row peak or of the peak in general tells us whether we are in a confined or deconfined regime. If we find a row peak which is temperature independent, we're in the confined zone. If the peak scales in temperature and moves out, we're in the deconfined zone. So that's the conclusion from dileptons. About photons, I have very little to say. Many other people here in the course of the meeting will say much more. I have very little to say because I can only report on data from my Gedanken experiment. And there are really no clear-cut lattice calculations for photon emission. There are analytic calculations, about those you will hear. But so I leave this open here for the moment and just say what one expects, of course, is that photons will also provide a thermometer for temperature at all scales. So if you can measure photons, this would be a way to check what comes out there. With one caveat that in the confined regime, in small momentum scales, there will certainly be contributions from the hadrons. And as you all know, at the SPS so far, one has essentially not really been able to give clearly identified thermal photons because of the overwhelming strength of these hadronic decays. So that brings me to the next points I want to talk about Quarkonia and jets. But before I do that, I want to make a short interlude of a more general nature on invasive probes. The crucial feature here is something which probably was first noted in connection with the Landau-Pomeranschuk-Migdal effect. And it's based on the following. This probe now goes through our bubble and interacts with the constituents of the medium. And this means there are two inherent time scales. The probe goes through the medium, and you imagine it hits somebody, and it hits somebody, and it hits somebody, and then it leaves. Now, so one time scale, obviously, is the collision time between two successive collisions, and that one can essentially express in terms of the cross-section and the density, that is, the mean free path in the medium. But the other time is how long it takes the probe after it was hit to recover, so to speak. If you imagine the probe to be a proton, you need at least enough time for the right side of the proton to tell the left side of the proton I was hit. So you need at least one Fermi in the rest frame of the proton. So the T naught is essentially that scale that it takes the probe, the time that it takes the probe to recover from the interaction or get back on shell or whatever you want to call it. And that means that there are two distinct regimes in the study of such probes. Remember, here the collision time is determined by density and cross-section. This is determined by the nature of the probe itself. So we can compare these two times and see which is bigger. And if we have what is the classic situation, the one that you imagine when this probe goes bonk, bonk, bonk through the medium and is deflected or something, that is true if the time it takes the probe to recover is very much shorter than the time needed before the next collision sets in. So this is, so to speak, the kinetic regime or a probabilistic regime in which you can say, I take the amplitude of all the different events, which is the sum of all the different scatterings, I square this amplitude, and what I find, in fact, is that it becomes the square of the interactions with the individual scattering center. So this is, so to speak, the classic kinetic regime. If, on the other hand, the time it takes the probe to recover is very much longer than the time between collisions, then, so to speak, the wounded probe is hit again and again and again as it goes through. And this means that we can no longer assume that the square of the sum becomes the sum of the squares. So in that case, there will be, as pointed out by Landau-Pomeranschuk and quantum mechanically Migdal, there will be destructive constructive interference terms, and that has to be taken into account. So in each case, for whatever probe we point out, we have to determine the cross-section for the interaction of the constituents with the probe. We have to determine the mean free path, collision time or the coherence length in the medium, that is the T collision. And presumably from statistical QCD, at one time or another, we will be able to get the density of the constituents in the medium. So this is quite general for all hard probes that I send through the medium. Now I want to turn to Quarkonia, and let me again show you what we want to see now. So we shoot a beam of Quarkonia into our bubble and watch if it's diminished or stopped or whatever when it comes out on the other side. The basis here is that the binding and the dissociation of Quarkonia is different depending on whether we are in a confined or deconfined medium. The start of this business was the observation that color screening in a plasma will dissociate or melt the J-psi, so in a hot plasma there should not be any J-psi. This of course leaves us with some rather profound questions, such as what about what happens to the J-psi in a confined medium? It may well disappear in a deconfined one, what happens in a confined one? And what is the relative role of screening versus collision, that is of the J-psi being hit by the constituent in the medium? And now here we immediately make use of our little interlude results. When the j psi traverses the medium, we have the collision time, we have the recovery time, and we therefore have then, when we compare these two regimes, a regime in which the recovery time is much shorter, so that's the collision regime, and a regime in which that time is much longer, and that's the collective regime. So what we have to know then is the collision time, which is density over cross-section, and the recovery time, which is essentially determined either by the binding energy or by the radius of the j psi. So what we need to know is the in-medium binding energy of the j psi. We need the in-medium cross-section, and we need density and screening radius of the medium. Now, not all of that is really known so very well today. What we have is the binding energy at zero temperature, where it's just the difference, the separation of the j psi mass from the open charm threshold. In the medium, as I noted in the section on statistical QCD, one can essentially determine twice the d mass as a function of temperature from Polyakov loop correlations so far in unquenched QCD. Ideally, one would like to determine quantities such as this or whatever else you need fully in finite temperature lattice QCD. This is not yet available, not yet possible with the present generation of computers, but hopefully in a few years it will be possible. So for the time being, we have to make use of some crutches, so to speak. And one possible crutch is to calculate the j psi mass as a function of temperature, which we need here in order to calculate the binding energy as a function of temperature from a Schrödinger equation. Or if you don't like the Schrödinger equation, you can also take a Bethe-Salpeter equation, but the mass is so heavy that it doesn't really matter. What we use in there is below Tc a Cornell potential, above Tc a screen Coulomb potential. We take all the temperature-dependent parameters that enter there from lattice QCD, and we then ask what happens as a function of temperature. I should note the string tension that we take from lattice QCD, even in full QCD, is of the form that gauge theory gives us. That is, the string, we assume the string tension goes to zero at Tc. Now, if you do this, what you find is shown in a few transparencies. What is shown here is the behavior of the mass of the psi, the chi c, and the psi prime as a function of temperature. And you see again the kind of behavior that I had mentioned before. It stays rather constant as a reflection of the fact that the string tension stays rather constant, almost up to Tc, and then it drops down. And above Tc, the only thing you can have, since the string tension is zero, is a Coulombic bound state. And so what you see here then is directly at Tc is the mass of the Coulombic bound state 1s, 1p, 2s. And then as you increase the temperature further, remember we are using a screened Coulomb potential, the screening mass rises with temperature, and this means that these bound states disappear at certain temperature points. Above those, no binding is possible anymore. So what you find then is, for the binding energy also, a behavior of this kind. It's more or less constant until you get near Tc for the j psi, then it drops suddenly, and it doesn't quite drop to zero because above Tc there is the, these curves are wrong, actually, forget them for the moment. They belong in a later picture. But for the j psi, this is correct, so it drops to a very small value. Above here we have only the binding energy from a screened Coulomb state, and so that is the pattern then we have to consider. This. Sorry?
Right.
right. I have not really talked about how to observe this. You are now talking
about the role of state.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. Right. So what I would expect is a behavior similar to that, although it's not so clear. I mean, what the this peak above TC in the case of the row came presumably because the row, the quarks acquire some kind of thermal mass. Now, the thermal mass of the CC bar is probably negligible. Compared to, okay. Let's talk about it. In any case, we have not looked at that. So you have to do the same thing for BV bar states, in particular for RIC and for the LHC. This will certainly be of great interest. And what one finds for the, let me move this over here, what one finds for the BV bar states is shown here. And again, a similar pattern, constant masses, then the drop to the Coulombic bound state, and then the various vanishing points for the different Coulombic bound states. For the upsilon itself, the binding energy here is still quite large compared to the J psi. I don't know whether any of you managed to look at the number, but the actual binding energy of the J psi directly at TC, that is the purely Coulombic binding energy, is really quite low. It's of the order of 100 MeV and very much dependent on what form you assume for the screening mass as a function of TC. So that then is the situation. What we now have to look at are cross sections and densities, and then we can say what regimes are relevant where. For the cross sections, the situation is not really in an ideal state. What we have made use of here is some earlier work with Dima, and there we obtained through an operator product expansion that the dissociation cross section of a J psi on hadrons is very, very small. This was obtained using a energy independent binding energy, temperature independent binding energy for the J psi. These calculations should be redone now with the temperature dependent binding energy. And so very near TC, there are some uncertainties. You saw the delta E as a function of T is more or less constant close to TC, but directly at TC, one has to be careful. Above TC, the dissociation cross-section is essentially pi times the square of the screening radius, and that leads to something like 2 millibonds. The density of constituents, well, we took that from lattice calculations from the pressure, since 1 over T times the pressure in at least semi-ideal statistical mechanics is something like the constituent density. And when you put all that in, what you find is that the collision time for the J psi has the form of this green curve, the recovery time has the form of the blue curve, and the two cross somewhere around TC. So what this tells us, perhaps not to many people's great surprise, is that the low temperature region is one in which collisions are relevant, and the high temperature region is one in which collective effects are relevant. Now, if we really want to study the survival of the J psi, then what we can do in the collision regime is take a Glauber formalism. This is meant to be just a generic expression for the Glauber formalism, putting in density, cross-section, and times. And what one finds, because of the smallness of the cross-section, is that this survival probability in the collision regime is very close to 1. One can say, besides such collisions, there could be thermal activation. Somehow, is it possible to lift the J psi thermally to its to the open charm state? One can do these calculations and again finds that this is really not significant up to the region around TC. So the conclusion we draw is that the J psi does survive up to around TC. Now, above TC, we had the Coulombic bound state. And in fact, one finds that the Coulombic bound state is dissolved at something like 1.5 TC. However, if you look at this picture, you see that already rather soon above TC, the binding energy is very much smaller than the temperature. And to talk about bound states when delta E is much smaller than TC probably does not make any sense. And to turn this into a quantitative statement, we calculate the activation rate for the values of delta E and T. And what one finds is that this activation rate really is, in fact, very large. And so essentially at TC, the survival probability of the J psi becomes zero. The moral of the story is above TC, it could survive as a Coulombic bound state. But since the binding energy is of the order of, or much smaller for higher T than the temperature, it is just thermally destroyed. So in some sense, then J psi suppression indicates that we have reached the deconfinement point. The higher excitations are quite amusing. For the higher excitations, what we do is we compare the mass of the states with the open charm threshold. And what you see is that, for example, the psi prime reaches 2MD. Well, let me start again. At T equals zero, the psi prime mass is slightly below the open charm threshold. So the psi prime cannot decay hadronically into 2Ds. But as you turn up the temperature, the D quark mass becomes lighter and lighter. And in this scheme that we have looked at, it becomes lighter according to this green curve. So at something like 0.2 TC, the psi prime mass becomes bigger than twice the D mass. So in a medium, the psi prime can now decay into 2Ds. Similarly, the chi at something like 0.7 TC reaches this point, and in a medium can decay into 2 hadrons. So what one then finds is that while the psi itself, which does not cross this green curve even at TC, the psi primes can survive up to TC and then exist as a bound state, the higher excited states become hadronically unstable in the medium below TC and can therefore disappear. Now, there is something I should warn you about with this curve. The open charm threshold, this green curve, was obtained from lattice QCD through Polyakov loop correlators. And these give you the color averaged potential. What you really want for such calculations is the color singlet potential. We have assumed that the color octet potential is zero. What one really should do is extract out the color singlet potential. Assuming the color octet potential to be zero makes this a lower bound. So if one does the thing correctly, what one gets is either this curve or one which runs somewhat above it. And you see, if it runs somewhat above it, these crossing points will move. So the actual position of these points is not something that you should believe for eternity. One should really wait until calculations extracting the color singlet potential are done. And then one can fix these points more quantitatively. Okay, that is, this I had mentioned already. For the final answer, rather than using something like a Schrödinger equation, which near TC also becomes of doubtful validity, would be to calculate everything directly from lattice QCD. But then you see that following a scheme of the kind that I had indicated here, one can really get conclusive results. For Bortomonia, there is left a somewhat more fundamental question. For all higher excited states, the situation is rather similar to what I had shown you for the J psi. For the upsilon itself, the binding and Coulombic binding energy at TC is of the order of 200 MeV or maybe more. And so there remains this question, can a Coulombically bound J psi survive in the hot plasma or not? For that, one needs quantitative calculations, and these don't exist yet. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
they cross the Bacon, and I believe this is all the discussion, they become something like a finism, which can be changed day by day.
Or like a roll.
Very close to the face case is very small, but the weak will fly small. So
yes.
Terrible,
yeah. Yeah, so what I would do is I would at that point then ask for the thermal activation rate. So the moment I have the exact crossing point,
and
then
put this more and start from zero.
Yeah.
So nothing's terrible.
Yeah. So the question of whether the upsilon survives remains open. The present status is illustrated here. What we find is that presumably the psi prime is well below TC in the medium dissociated into open charm mesons. And then there is a region near TC in which we have the psi and probably also the upsilon prime in the chi B, a region somewhat below that for chi, upsilon double prime, and so on, and a region above that where the dissociation occurs at these points, which are something like 20 to 30% above or below TC. But for the moment, one does not really have any quantitative calculations here. But what you see is if you could, this as a comment to the possibilities of Rick, if you could really measure all these states, since they all are dissociated in a region very closely around TC, if one has precision measurements, this would really serve in some sense as a microscope for the transition, for the behavior around the transition region. And if you have this very sharp behavior as a function of TC. If you now turn to a study of this behavior as a function of the energy density, then of course you spread this out and amplify it over a very much larger region. Okay, that brings me to my final probe, the jets, which somehow lose their momentum as they go through the medium. And what we want to look at is shown here. Again, our little interlude comes into play. We need the time between the successive collisions of the jet going through the medium and the time it takes the jet to emit a radiative photon. In the incoherent regime, where this time is much shorter than the time between collisions, the energy loss is just the number of such photons emitted times the energy of these photons. So the energy loss per unit length is energy over mean free path. And if you integrate that out, you see that you just get energy times path length over mean free path, which is the number of collisions. The interesting situation comes in the coherent regime. And here you will hear things in more detail by Rolf Bayer reporting on the work of this collaboration by Bayer, Dockschütter, Müller, Penier, and Schiff. And what you have there is the length the jet traverses, the distance the jet passes between being hit and wanting to emit a photon is much longer than the distance between successive scatterings. And what happens is that these successive scatterings therefore lead to destructive interference and a much smaller energy loss. So instead of having this formula, energy over mean free path, you have energy over mean free path times the ratio of this distance over that distance, mean free path over coherence length. And this is much smaller than one and leads to a reduced energy loss. So in order to make this quantitative, you have to calculate the coherence length as a function of energy and medium. And this has been done in the work that I had just mentioned. And what one finds is that this energy loss is mu squared over lambda, I'll explain that in a minute, times either the mean free, the coherence length, if we're in a bulk medium, which is very, very large, or times the size of the medium, if we're in a thin medium, where the jet reaches the edge before it has reached the coherence length. This transport coefficient, which determines the energy loss, is expressed in terms of mu squared and lambda. The mu squared is the average kick that the jet gets per scattering going through the medium, and that can be expressed in terms of the cross section of the jet in the medium. And so what you get is, for this transport coefficient, a form consisting basically of two factors. One is the density of the medium, and one is, so to speak, the scattering power or scattering loss in the medium. And this then determines jet quenching. Now, what you have to do is calculate, this is presumably given by, ideally given by lattice QCD, this you have to calculate for your given jet. And this cross-section that enters here is the high energy limit for the scattering of the jet on whatever constituent it finds. So if we are below TC, it will be the scattering of the jet on hadrons, above TC, on partons. So without knowing for the moment what this number is, we know that it is some number which multiplies the density. And so what we find is that, yes, what we find is that with constants, depending on whether we're in the confined or deconfined zone, the transport coefficient has the, is linear in the density. And so deconfinement, in terms of jet quenching, means a slope change as we pass from the confined to the deconfined regime if we plot the thing as a function of the density. What is, of course, not clear is whether the slope change is abrupt enough to identify really a critical point. Hopefully, what these calculations will give us is a quantitative behavior for the jet quenching in the hot medium. To estimate whether this is possible, whether it's possible to identify this or not, I look again at the pressure as a function of temperature. And what you find here is that they change rather smoothly. There is a significant variation, but it is not clear whether you really see the correct point at one or whether you see it somewhat further up. So that is what, in our simple experiment, in our simple Gedanken experiment, you could calculate from, you could obtain, hope to obtain from jet quenching. That brings me to the end. The outlook, the first conclusion is, I think, we can really be all quite optimistic. This Gedanken experiment was conclusive in many ways. A summary is given here. We can determine the temperature by looking at the large mass dileptron spectrum, and I would hope also eventually by photons. One can calculate, one can specify the state of the medium by looking at the temperature behavior of the peak in the dileptron spectrum and by seeing whether there are jape size around. For the transition details, hopefully, if one can really measure all the different quarkonium states, one would have quite a strong handle on what happens there. In medium hadrons, for light hadrons, again, dileptrons in the sense of rows, as I had just looked at, for quarkonia, perhaps you could compare jape psi versus upsilon and see, test the upsilon behavior in the deconfined regime. So if I separate the two into a warm QGP and a hot QGP, the warm meaning, let's say, in the region up to 1.5 TC, then this can hopefully be investigated by looking at the origin of the dileptron peak and by looking at the behavior of jape psi versus upsilon. The hot QGP itself, I think, will rely mainly on large mass dileptrons and on jets. The final points are sort of questions. First of all, the obvious one, I have not mentioned nuclear collision complications. You all want some work to do for a week, so I leave that for you. The question that I want to leave you with is of a more general nature, and that is equilibration really somehow necessary for a transition from a confined to a deconfined state? I mean, basically, confinement binds partons into, forces partons to follow hadronic parton distribution functions. And this uses up energy. So if you deconfine them, they generally become harder. And for example, for charmonium dissociation, this hardening is enough. You do not really need an equilibrated medium. Another interesting question that arises in this context is something like whether color glass is pre-deconfined matter. People talk about parton saturation setting in when in the transverse plane, the transverse area of the partons overlap through the entire plane. Now this is a phenomenon which is known in statistical physics, and it's called percolation, and it is a critical behavior with critical exponents and universality classes and so on. And it would be somehow amusing if in such collisions there are two kinds of critical behavior. There's critical behavior connected with the onset of parton saturation and critical behavior related to deconfinement. So the main theoretical question that I want to leave you with, which I think is really quite amusing, what is the relation between this color glass formation, parton saturation, and so on, as a sense of, in a sense, a structural mathematical critical phenomenon to the deconfinement that we wanted to study here? Thank you. Well, you see, the crucial factor in calculating in this operator product expansion, calculating the J psi hadron cross section, is the binding energy of the J psi. I mean, there are two things. First of all, the calculation becomes exact in the limit of large quark mass. So there is always an intrinsic uncertainty because you're working for really not infinite quark masses. And so it would be better for the upsilon than for the J psi. This is something which is rather difficult to estimate. But if you assume that the charm quark mass is large enough so that you can do these calculations, then the crucial factor is the binding energy of the J psi. And all calculations that, to my knowledge, have been done so far have used the zero temperature binding energy. What one really should do is now calculate the temperature dependence of this cross section using a temperature dependent binding energy. This let me not answer. I mean, I wanted to use this as an external probe, and the question of to what degree there are thermal J psi's in the medium or not, thermal CC bar pairs in the medium or not, and can bind in the medium. This is something which has been addressed in some recent papers, but I don't think I can comment on that.
I like your argumentation on time scales.
Mm-hmm.
That you can just get from length scales.
Mm-hmm.
But all studies how systems thermalize show that actually typically several time scales how it thermalizes. Some of them much longer than the minimal scale that you would get. And I think this is probably also true for the type of recovery time scale. It depends somehow on the detail to which you want to study phenomena if this recovery time scale is really important. So I wonder if that would not really affect the quantitative conclusion, for example, if you say G psi is essentially unchanged until the critical temperature or something.
No, all I wanted to say here actually is, I mean, first of all, the probes that I'm looking at are not thermal. So they are external probes. So I'm not worried about thermalization time scales or anything like that. So basically what I'm asking is what is the length of time necessary between a scattering of a hard quark and the subsequent emission of a photon or gluon of this hard quark. And what we have generally taken there is the virtuality of the intermediate state. Now, if you want to make another model, this is certainly possible. But what we have always taken for whenever this question of T naught arose, we have said we determine this by the virtuality of the intermediate state.
As you know, there are some very beautiful and useful sublimits. Have you thought of applying some of these to a Duncan experiment, such as the area and the globe?
To be honest, no. But that would be, let's talk about it afterwards. I mean, that would certainly be a possibility.
There
Because I think if you go to, let's say, the collider energy regulation, the time scale for formation of a dense state, whether it's in full equilibrium or not, I don't care, is the order of a fraction of a Fermi. So isn't it then much more appropriate to send in beams of C and C bars or B and C bars and not beams of Borkonia to test what is actually coming? Because you don't have a Borkonian form that
No, I mean, from an experimental point of view, I mean, from the experimental feasibility of producing beams, that may be correct. But the reason I'm using quarkonium beams is because I believe that we can calculate the cross-section of the scattering of a quarkonium on constituents of matter, and that this scattering differs if the constituents are hadrons and or not. If I, or partons, if I would use a D beam, then I'm basically in the, or a CC bar beam, then I'm basically in the, something like jet physics. And that, I mean, there has been some very interesting work of Dokshitzer and Kazeyev where they study the energy loss of hard quarks in a medium. So this is certainly a tool. And it's a very interesting tool, but it addresses something else than what I want to address here. I mean,
but you somehow assume that the quarkonia all formed before the system happens in a clear beam, and I just question whether this has any relevance to reality.
Oh, but that's why I call it the Gedanken experiment.
Yeah, but one last question.
Yeah, that's actually a very, very good and very important point. I mean, if you calculate in full QCD to determine that the string tension vanishes at TC is a somewhat academic endeavor. I mean, you can't really do that. So in the actual calculations that we have done for for the temperature dependence of the quark masses, what we have really done is we have taken the potential from QCD, parameterized in some rather complicated way, and put that in. So that gives you a rapid variation, but it does not give you the vanishing directly at TC. No, what happens even in full QCD is that if you look at the plateau, I think I have a picture of this. If you look at the plateau as a function of T, here we are. You see what happens is if you look at the plateau level, it's this one that's relevant. If you look at the plateau level as a function of TC, you find as the temperature increases, the plateau level goes down. And if you now plot this plateau level as a function of temperature, it goes down with a very strong variation. And it's this strong variation that I've called 2MD. So what you're saying is I can, from this behavior, perhaps not without further input, arrive at a situation where 2MD is zero at TC. It might have a small tail. But the only thing that will lead to in such pictures here is, or the only conclusion you would get in this picture, is that in the region around here, there is uncertainty. And this uncertainty is there anyways. And I think the only way to really get out of that eventually is to do lattice calculations of the charmonium masses.